Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this podcast, we will be looking at news from the week beginning the 22nd of July. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story, Kate, is based on new research from the TUC that points to a looming skills crisis. The Training Trends in Britain report notes that, with automation and new technology changing the way many of us work, millions of us will need to reskill over the next 20 years, but the state of current provision looks unequal to the task. On average, the study shows, the amount of training that workers are having this year is 10% less than they had in 2011. For young and lower qualified workers, the figures are even lower. Indeed, the report notes younger workers have lost the equivalent of a day's training per year. Factors behind the slump are said to include weak oversight and regulation of both the quality and duration of apprenticeship training and the absence of a social partnership governance model found in other countries with high-quality apprenticeship systems. Kate, what must leaders do to turn this falling workplace training around?
Well, it seems that the apprenticeship model isn't delivering what it was designed to do, which was essentially a social partnership with employers at the fore, designing the training they needed for their organisations and their markets. What often worries me about talk of training is how we measure it in a number of days. And it's an easy target to count, or it's an easy number to count. But does it really give any insight into whether it's the right training, whether it's having the right impact, whether it's delivering the sorts of skills that we need to keep pace with technology? It's not working. I think that's absolutely right of the TUC to bring our attention to this. But I think some work at the University of Winchester done a couple of years ago seem to indicate that the better companies are carrying on training irrespective of what's happening in the broader landscape. And that will continue to be the case, that they will be filling their own skills gap, which of course is not a concerted effort on the part of government. It's not a social partnership. It's just been so market driven.
Thank you very much for your insight on that story, Kate. Our next story asks, who needs 5 days? A reference to the UK's Labour Party considering a proposal to trim the 5-day week for public sector workers down to 4. The debate about the length of the working week has crisscrossed other countries and organisations, and while a 4-day work week is still not practical in many cases, proponents say more flexible schedules can spur greater productivity and engagement from employees. Many organisations are locked into this mental model of going to work from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, says Emma Cornwall, a London-based Korn Ferry associate client partner focused on central government. What the 4-day week offers is the recognition that our lives are more complex now, with people trying to balance jobs, careers, and their caring responsibilities. Kate, what more can be done for organisations to realise the limitations of the traditional 5-day working week?
We've been hearing a lot about this recently, and I think it's undoubtedly the case that the trend towards shorter working weeks is part of progress, and that we are now working fewer hours than we did 50 years ago, and 50 years' time we'll be working fewer hours than we are doing now. So that is, I think, beyond question. Whether it will be 4 days is a different thing altogether, and it seems so many industries can't function for only 4 days, especially if they're customer facing, especially if they're leisure and hospitality. They have to keep their show on the road 24/7, or at least something close to that. So my concern here is that it might be available to a privileged few. And then we have to ask questions about empty office space and what happens if everybody goes home and we have a 3-day weekend, which, to be honest, Rod, I think is very unlikely. But some people will use their increased leisure time to work more, especially if they're on minimum wage, because they won't be able to fund fewer working hours. It's an interesting problem for organisations. And of course, flexible working is a solution to this, more creative and imaginative ways of scheduling work, managing workers. But also the charity sector have got to think about this, because one assumes that there are going to be so many more hours available for people to volunteer with all the associated problems of managing volunteers. So it's something that I think is going to engage many of us for a long time.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story asks if flexible workers should be compensated for cancelled shifts. Issued on the 16th of July, Good Work Plan follows on from the 2017 Taylor Review of Modern Working Practices, which examined the staffing implications of new forms of work and the impact of new working methods on worker rights, responsibilities, freedoms and obligations. The consultation looks at what has been termed as one-sided flexibility, with examples of employers cancelling shifts at short notice or sending workers home when customer demand is low. In light of the Taylor Review, the Independent Low Pay Commission recommends that employees should have a right to switch to a contract that reflects normal hours worked, a right to reasonable notice of work schedule, compensation for shift cancellation or curtailment without reasonable notice, and guidelines and information that will inform their expectations. Kate, do you consider these proposals by the LPC to be sound and workable?
Well, what they're actually suggesting is the end of the 0 hours contract. I mean, this is a contract of employment, is it not? Which, of course, reduces the flexibility that 0 hours contracts certainly provide. And I think this one-sided flexibility, we have challenged that. It's only really flexible if it suits both partners. And if it's just a way of keeping down labour costs, then it's not flexible. It's sort of verging on the exploitative and really does remind me of ragged trousered philanthropist Trestles. He was looking at workers in a very similar situation where they're only paid for work that they do when it's wanted, and that can easily, very quickly, just be stopped, and they have no alternative income arrangements. So absolutely, again, you know, Matthew Taylor's doing some good work in trying to ensure that work is good and fair.
Thank you very much, Kate, and a particularly interesting reference there to the ragged trousered philanthropist. Our next story looks at how Sainsbury's revamped its Bath branch into the UK's first ever sign language supermarket between 18th and 21st of July in an experiment tied into its 150 days of community volunteering effort. Sainsbury's Company Secretary and Corporate Services Director Tim Fallowfield said, "We want to be the most inclusive retailer where people love to work and shop, and it's really important to us that we support both customers and colleagues with hearing difficulties to feel as comfortable as possible in our stores wherever we can." Long-term News and Views readers will recall that Sainsbury's has form on this front. In June last year, we reported that the retailer had trialled a slow checkout lane for dementia sufferers at a store in Prestwick, Scotland. At the time, a Sainsbury's spokesperson said, "Our aim is to be the most inclusive retailer and we want all of our customers to have a great shopping experience in our stores." Kate, whilst that is undoubtedly a noble aspiration, won't it take a lot more than short-term trials in individual stores for the brand to properly refashion itself as a truly inclusive customer experience?
It does show how complex diversity, inclusivity initiatives are, and the scale of them. And this is one of Sainsbury's in excess of 1,400 stores. And this has obviously involved the staff in a huge amount of work, additional training for people to learn how to sign, everything that's gone into making this work. But unless we do things like this, you can't change attitude. You can't make workforces more inclusive without some big changes. And it's not an incremental change. It's big initiatives that get a lot of attention, a lot of positive publicity in this case. It's good for Sainsbury's, absolutely good news for the hearing impaired community.
Thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thanks, Rod.